Happy Bitcoin Monday, freaks. It's your host, Odell, here for another Citadel Dispatch, the show focused on actionable Bitcoin and freedom tech discussion. Hope you all had a great weekend. We got another great week of Bitcoin ahead of us, starting off with this conversation. But before I get started, just another huge shout out to all the freaks who continue to support the show with Bitcoin. Dispatch is audience funded. Without ads or sponsors, it would not be possible without all of your generous donations. So thank you for supporting the show. It truly means a lot. The easiest way to support the show is by going to citadeldispatch.com/donate. And you can donate through on-chain Bitcoin or Lightning Bitcoin. You can leave a message if you want to leave a message. You can attach your Twitter account to the donation if you want to climb the leaderboard. Or you can donate anonymously if that pleases you. You can also donate via my PayNim. That is a human readable identifier for BIP47 payment code. It is supported in Samurai, Sparrow Wallet, and Stack Wallet. My identifier is Odell, very easy to remember. And last but not least, you can support the show via podcasting 2.0 apps like Fountain Podcast, Breeze Wallet, EchoLN.com, Podverse. I think Podbean now supports it. There's a lot of apps that support it. They work like a regular podcasting app. You search Citadel Dispatch, you click that subscribe button, you choose how much Bitcoin per minute you think the show is worth, and those sats are streamed directly to my node. It is incredibly cool seeing sats streamed directly to my node. Some of you freaks might have noticed that after my recent episode with CK, your streams were failing. That was because my node went down. That is one of the trade-offs of sovereignty. There's a lot of so-called Bitcoiners out there using custodial wallets with their podcasts. I choose to use my own node. That means sometimes it'll go down for a few days and I'll lose my whole stream of sats. But it is what it is. Personal responsibility requires responsibility. So thank you to the freaks who noticed that and let me know. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have noticed for another day or two. And I appreciate you all who continued to support it after that to make up for the fact of the failed payments. Just for what it's worth, if my node's down, the money isn't lost. I just don't get it. It stays in your wallet and I just don't receive it. With podcasting 2.0, you can also do something called a boostagram. You can think of that as a global message board where you're able to put a comment and then attach a certain amount of sats to it, a certain amount of Bitcoin to it. I read the top four boostagrams from the previous show every episode. We have at Nico Neck Nick with 210,000 sats saying, "Everyone is more than welcome to attend BTC Prague conference June 8th through 10th, where these topics will be discussed as well. Check the awesome, still growing list of speakers at btcprague.com. Prague is a cradle of slush pool in 2010, world's first international conference in 2011, first hardware wallet prototype in 2012, BIP39 seed creation, first Bitcoin ATM, first Bitcoin-only cafe, first ASIC custom firmware, deep Bitcoin roots in a beautiful city, btcprague.com, June 8th through 10th, stay humble and stack sats." Well, that was kind of an ad, but it looks like it's going to be a good event, so I don't feel too horrible about it. We have at Scarce City with 125,000 sats saying, "Thanks for the fun rip. Always appreciate the messaging regarding survival. Boosting enough sats for Matt or CK to take a Muay Thai class." Thank you, Scare City. Great dude. We have at Auburn Citadel with 100,000 sats. "It's all so tiresome. The freaks keep me in a positive frame of mind." Then we have Ride or Die Freak at Eric99 with 50,000 sats saying, "Stay humble, stack sats. When I went to Geyser Fund page, there's a red X and says unstable wallet. Can I still donate there and will it get to you?" So that's what I was saying about my node being down. As you all know, there was a lot of freaks supported the show. You can look them up by going to Fountain or another podcasting 2.0 app, and you can see all the other comments. I really do appreciate it. Last but not least, I know it's a bear market. I know it's a recession, maybe global economic depression. If you can't spare any sats, you can also support the show by subscribing on your favorite platform. Dispatch is available on all of them. Bitcoin TV, YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, every single podcast app. Just search Citadel Dispatch and click the subscribe button. Leaving reviews help. Sharing it with friends and family help. Get that signal out there. No matter where this world takes us, I will be broadcasting from my city. That's yours. So I appreciate when you guys share it. And then one more shout out. Dispatch is very unique in that we have a live audience, a live interactive chat. That's either through our Matrix chat, which is operating 24/7, 365 and self-hosted on Citadel servers. We also have the chat that streams in from YouTube and Twitch. So if you're able to join the live shows, that is extremely appreciated because that's what makes the show really unique. And I kind of think of you guys all as hosts. Okay. All those links are at citadeldispatch.com. Thank you all for going through that with me on this Monday afternoon. So with all that said, I have a great guest here today, someone I've been friends with online for a long time, briefly met in 2019, which feels like almost a decade ago. We have Dave Bradley here, who goes by Bitcoin Brains on Twitter. How's it going, Dave?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
The pleasure is all mine. I'm glad to finally have you on the show. So Dave, I mean, I don't know where to start. I mean, how I knew you the best was as co-founder of Bull Bitcoin, the infamous Canadian exchange or Bitcoin business or brokerage. I don't know what you would classify it as. We have Rand Moore in the comments asking for the Matrix link. It's just citadeldispatch.com/chat. So Dave, why don't you tell us your Bull Bitcoin story? Let's start with that.
Yeah, well, you know what? Why don't I give you the lead up to that too? Because that's kind of fundamental to where we got there.
Go for it.
So I got into Bitcoin in 2010, kind of like at the end of the CPU mining era, like right when GPU mining became a real thing, and I was like mining in my basement. I had no idea what hard money was. You know, I was looking at Bitcoin as like a get rich quick scheme, like a lot of people do when they first get in. And I was like mining Bitcoin in my basement and selling it on local Bitcoins and buying more video cards and mining more Bitcoin. And got to a point where I was like, I need to make this a real business, because I was like meeting people at coffee shops with cash and they probably thought I was a drug dealer at the coffee shop. So in 2013, me and a friend opened a store, like a physical brick and mortar store called Bitcoin Brains, which is now my handle and personal brand. And we were like, yeah, we were selling Bitcoin over the counter. We were selling mining equipment and like whatever else we get our hands on that was related to Bitcoin and doing consultations and whatnot. Later sold the store there, but kept the brokerage alive doing OTC stuff. And that brought me, to a place where I was doing a lot of business with Francis, in Montreal. And I was kind of flying around the country doing different OTC deals. And, you know, we were very ideologically aligned. I would say that the roots of what started Bull Bitcoin came from an article, I guess, that Francis and I wrote. This would have been like, I think 2016, probably 2016 when the block size wars were just kind of getting started. And
right.
There was a proposal called Bitcoin Unlimited. And it was basically a hard fork that involved a block size increase. And, you know, I'm not sure what else they threw in there, but it was getting a little bit of support. Roger Ver and some others were backing it. And we were talking and we didn't know each other nearly as well then, Francis and I. And we were like, you know what, this is kind of bullshit that these guys think they're in charge. And so we kind of gathered the Canadian Bitcoin community. We got, I think, 16 different companies that were all fairly small, to sign this letter that was basically saying like, Canada says, fuck you to Bitcoin Unlimited. Like we're not in. And, that kind of led to, Francis and I becoming better friends. And, you know, I like, when we agreed to write that thing, I was like, I'm pretty good at writing. And I was like, I'll probably carry this. But then I like see Francis and he's just like on a different level. Delivers nothing but pure signal. And I was like, man, this guy's for real. So
Bitcoin Unlimited was the Gavin one, right? Gavin was, it was early days. It was before the block size war, like was in full swing, right?
Yeah, it was before. I don't really know or care who it was. Like it was one of those people.
It was, the idea was, wasn't that idea was like, you go to 2 megs block size, then 4, then 6, then 8, like you keep, hence unlimited, right?
Yeah. There was a series of bad proposals and alternative clients and stuff like that throughout that period that all kind of were just like knee-jerk reactions to an attempt to solve this one problem, which was the, you know, the blocks filling up.
Right.
It was like, we're very lucky we avoided falling for any of those things because they all had like the Cobra effect written all over them where, you know, there's no way to know what the consequences of changing things mid-flight would have been, right? So anyway, we wrote that like very much saying, you know, for what it matters, we're 16 pretty small companies, but we're economic nodes that have a meaningful impact on the consensus.
Right.
And so we said, yeah, we're not doing that. And I think some of that energy is what led ultimately to the UASF, which was basically like the ultimate, like all the small players in the community telling the big ones to fuck off. And yeah.
I recently had BitMEX research on, and he wrote The Block Size War. So anyone who's listening right now, if you weren't here for this, like this was a pivotal point in Bitcoin history, and it's really easy for me and Dave to not really appreciate that the newcomers have no idea what happened. And that you guys should really read it if you weren't here at the time, because it's important for Bitcoin's security model in general.
Yeah, it's very important. And I think one thing that gets forgotten a little bit is that with the UASF, Bitcoin conclusively proved that it is the only network. Well, it didn't prove it was the only one, but it proved that it was a network that was fully decentralized. You know, you had all the big players, all the big miners agreeing to a change, and the community getting together and saying, absolutely not, you're not in charge. And that's what separates when we're seeing all this stuff. We'll probably get into later all this Binance and all the bullshit going on with US regulators. And that's what sets Bitcoin apart, is the fact that it's been proven that no one is in charge. And that one detail may become very relevant, hopefully in the near future, if they're starting to go after some of these other coins.
100%. I mean, that's what, and a lot of, It's crazy because, I mean, we've been talking about this stuff publicly. I mean, I personally maybe logged 5,000 hours of podcasts talking about this subject. And most people still do not realize, like, the whole Greenpeace thing that we've been dealing with the last 6 months, funded by Ripple, which, by the way, Greenpeace is a terrorist organization before they even found out the word Bitcoin existed. Revolves around this idea that someone controls it. It's such a simple concept, but that's so crazy for individuals to comprehend. Most Bitcoin deniers still to this day, most average people have no concept that no one controls it, which is insane.
Yeah. And it's pretty hard for some people to see the nuances there where, you know, to all intents and purposes, like everybody's got their like cousin who's super into crypto and wants to tell you everything. That guy has no idea that Ethereum is not decentralized.
Right. Yeah.
So,
well, that's our edge still to this day. Okay. Yeah, so you wrote this piece, you guys connected, you had a bromance a bit, right? And that's where we are in the story.
Yeah. So, Francis and I became good friends, and we had this idea that we wanted to roll a bunch of different Bitcoin companies in Canada all together and make like this super company. And we had a bunch of talks with some different players in the space and didn't really find anyone else that was really fully aligned. But in 2018, Francis and I ended up combining our efforts and forming Bull Bitcoin, which was basically the merger of Bills and Satoshi Portal, which Francis had created, and my company, Bitcoin Brains. And really with the goal of being like, you know, the voice for Bitcoin maximalism in Canada and the most advanced Bitcoin platform in the world. And I think Bull has accomplished that pretty well. So I was with Bull from 2018 to 2020. I left Bull Bitcoin at the start of 2020 to form a company called Ghost Lab, with the intention we were making software for Bitcoin ATMs. That was something that I had a lot of people sort of asking me about. And ultimately what that led to was I was reaching out to somebody that I'd known in the industry for a long time, Adam O'Brien, who's the CEO of Bitcoin Well, where I'm at now. And we were talking about this software, and he's like, yeah, I want to do that too. And so we ended up partnering up on this software. And then at some point he's like, hey, can you help me take my company, which at the time was called Bitcoin Solutions, which is a Bitcoin ATM company at the time. Can you help me take this public? And I was like, well, you know what? I've never done that, but like, I could probably figure it out. And so that's what I did. I joined up with this company. We ended up rolling the ATM software company in. And it's all part of one company that we rebranded to Bitcoin Well when we went public, which was the first publicly traded Bitcoin ATM company in the world. And so, yeah, we've got about 300 of those around Canada. We have offices in Calgary and Edmonton where we buy and sell Bitcoin. And then we've got an online platform that we've launched sort of near the start of the year in Canada that is, you know, the simplest possible way. So the way that I describe Bull Bitcoin is like it's the most advanced Bitcoin platform in the world. Francis was on a show called the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast, I think last week, or the week before, talking about that. And Bull Bitcoin is very unique in that like it's built from scratch. You know, right. All of the infrastructure, the nodes, everything is built in-house. And that gives a lot more leeway to do advanced features and to really target the like 1%, the remnant, the like most hardcore Bitcoiners in the world. And that's who that's built for. And then we've taken a little bit of different approach with Bitcoin Well, where we're like, we're building the opposite. We're building like the simplest possible thing. So bank to Bitcoin in Canada is about 30 seconds once you're signed up right now. And there's no other features. You can buy and sell Bitcoin. And that's pretty much it at the current stage.
Well, first, let's just take a deep breath here. Can you turn off your notifications on your computer? Because I heard a Slack notification and it gives me PTSD.
Yes, that's me, actually. Sorry.
You're good. You're good. I've seen people try and push through it, and it's definitely a worse situation. So I didn't realize you guys went public with this company. That's pretty crazy going public. I guess before we go there, were you involved in the Montreal Bitcoin Embassy?
I was not. I'm in Calgary. We like our
Francis store, had that before Bull Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was Francis didn't start the Bitcoin Embassy. That was some other Bitcoiners in Montreal, and they basically hired Francis to be like the government relations piece, and he ended up then starting Satoshi Portal, which is like the OTC desk that they ran out of the store, out of the front.
Got it.
And that was actually like the only part that was really successful. Like the embassy was awesome, but when it comes right down to it, like our entire industry is about selling Bitcoin. And that's really been what's fueled this entire industry, and everything else that people have built around that mostly just supports that one thing.
Well, it's definitely the most proven business model.
Yeah. Absolutely.
At least up to date right now.
Yeah, exactly. So what we were running in Calgary was in a lot of ways pretty similar. It was like the hub for Bitcoin here. And having a physical space is something like we have a physical space now in Calgary, and we have one in Edmonton, but it's a little different in that, you know, there's a bunch of these things around the country now. And so it doesn't become quite as much of a hub. It used to be like the only place to go if you wanted to talk about Bitcoin, which was really cool.
Right. Yeah. No, the reason I bring it up is because when I was a young Bitcoiner, I don't know if it was like 2015 or somewhere around there. You know, Bitcoin was down from all-time highs, like 90%. And I was at a family wedding in Montreal. And me and my family, my parents walked by the Montreal Bitcoin Embassy. And like that was the moment they decided I wasn't a crazy person, was because there's just this random physical location in Canada. And to this day, I still think, I mean, I don't know if you're aware, but I co-founded a physical Bitcoin campus in Nashville, Tennessee. Yep. And that is the number one biggest reason to have a physical community location, is because it makes it real for people as they walk by. They walk by, they see it, they're like, holy shit, this is a real thing. And then it starts turning the wheels and starts getting them going, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. We got this ad that I don't know if it's still there anymore. We got virtually no like commercial response from it. And it was basically just like a shipping container with our like banner, et cetera, on the side of the highway between Calgary and Edmonton. And as far as I know, we got no business out of that at all. But I hear from a lot of people when they're like, oh, Bitcoin, I've seen that shipping container. They don't even know that it's necessarily us.
There you go.
They've got a link to the tangible reality of the world now that they see all the time. And that's like, it's the way that realtors use bus benches. You know what I mean? You see them a billion times and then eventually it creeps into your head.
Yep. I can definitely relate to that. So where do we want? So Bitcoin Well, you guys are a public company. I've never heard of you, until you mentioned it, in our messages before the show. Are you guys doing a lot of business in Canada? I mean, you're Canadian only, right? Which is, I'm not Canadian. So
that's the main reason probably why you'd never heard of us. And like we were talking right before the show here, and that's part of the reason why I haven't gone on like a whole bunch of like American podcasts is because we weren't doing business in the US, and you know, almost every podcast, most of the market is in the US. And so I was a little bit quieter, and now we've been operating in the Canadian market for 10 years. So we kind of know what we're doing, I think, when it comes to selling Bitcoin. We've got this online platform that we think is really solid in terms of like speed, simplicity, and price. And we're just taking that experience and expanding that to the US here soon. So we've got an expansion plan for the spring. We should be launching just like a very, very basic non-custodial way to buy Bitcoin straight from your bank to your wallet in as few steps as possible.
Got it. So how does that look?
It's funny because your payments in some ways, like your traditional fiat payment rails in the US, are actually a bit worse than what we have in Canada.
Yeah. And we're the worst in the world, I think. I mean, the developed world.
So we've got something called Interact e-Transfer that's fairly ubiquitous here, and it's not very good, but it is like a more or less instant. Sometimes it takes a few hours for no apparent reason, but same day way to pay small amounts of money within Canada. And that's been the dominant payment rail for most of the Bitcoin industry in Canada. In the US, it looks like ACH payments, but it's basically we're going to be taking ACH payments from our clients, allowing those to basically create a balance in fiat that the moment they want to make a purchase, the Bitcoins are sent directly to their wallet. So we do technically hold our customers' fiat, which is kind of unavoidable in a world with very slow and unpredictable payments, but for as little time as possible. And we don't hold the Bitcoins at all. We deliver them immediately, which I think is, you know, with all this shit that we've seen in the last year with custody and blow-ups of exchanges, that's something that we learned several times the hard way in Canada. And the rest of the world is now seeing in spectacular fashion.
I mean, that's been something that Bull Bitcoin has always held fast on, right? There's no custodial wallet on Bull Bitcoin. It's just, they exchange your fiat directly to your non-custodial wallet, your self-custody wallet, proper Bitcoin wallet. I hate it. It's just like, it's either a wallet or it's like a custodial account. Like there should be no such thing as a custodial wallet. We've already lost that narrative.
Yeah, that's a weird vernacular, actually, when you think about it. If it's like your bank wallet, you know.
Yeah. So you guys are a public company. You're currently operating in Canada. What is the Canadian product? So help me out here. I assume you're a co-founder of Bull Bitcoin. I assume you still have some kind of equity stake in Bull Bitcoin. People are in Canada. They're Bitcoiners. They love using Bull Bitcoin. Like, what is the trade-off balance? Like, why would someone choose Bitcoin? And I'm sorry if this is an unfair question, but this is, I think, the question everyone is curious about, including myself. Why would someone use Bitcoin Well versus Bull Bitcoin? What are the trade-offs between the two?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the trade-offs are pretty clear. Like I said, Bull Bitcoin is the most advanced Bitcoin platform in the world. There's all these features that nobody even really notices. Like every single order gets a cryptographically signed receipt. It's verifiable on open timestamps. Any coins that come into the company, and there are a lot because the legacy of Bills, which was a bill payment service. So a lot of people a lot of the clients of Bull Bitcoin, probably more than any other exchange in the world, are people selling Bitcoin.
Right.
You know, most are dominated by people buying Bitcoin. So
they're paying their bills, like their electric bills or something. They send Bitcoin in and then Bull Bitcoin pays the bills.
Yeah, exactly. And that's technically a sell, right? So
right.
That's basically what's going on at Bull Bitcoin. Bull Bitcoin has as clients the CEOs of every major Bitcoin company in Canada, pretty much. So Bull Bitcoin has a lock on the hardcore users, I would say.
Okay.
And if you want things like CoinJoin on the way in when you sell your coins, if you want those cryptographically signed receipts, Bull Bitcoin is the best one to use. Absolutely. It is the strongest platform, and it's the strongest base. And it's probably, knowing Francis, like Francis is probably the most hardcore Bitcoiner in the world. So it's, probably the last company where your personal information could end up in the hands of the government, for example. So that's how I would define Bull Bitcoin. Bitcoin, well, we're taking a broader approach. So we're not building as many things that are targeting the hardcore users. It's more like, where do you send your aunt to get Bitcoin?
Okay, so more user-friendly.
Yeah, and you know what? They're both user-friendly. There's a lot more going on with Bull Bitcoin.
Right.
But where we're really trying to optimize with Bitcoin Well, which is different than Bull Bitcoin, Bull Bitcoin is, like I said, trying to build the best stuff possible, the best platform possible. Bitcoin Well is trying to build the easiest platform possible, the most user-friendly and the most streamlined. So that stat that I mentioned, you have to go through when you sign up like a KYC process, which, you know, there are legal reasons that we have to do that. But the main one is an anti-fraud piece because fiat payments are not reliable, so they can be reversed in cases of fraud. And so we have to know who we're dealing with. Once you get through that KYC process, though, the process of buying Bitcoin and, from your bank to your Bitcoin is literally about 30 seconds. Once you send one of those e-transfers, unless you run into the random detail where the fiat system sometimes takes longer than expected. But when that transfer is sent, the Bitcoins are sent immediately and there's no faster or cheaper way. And as a result, because it's so fast, that's the safest way. You know, we've got custody of a user's funds for seconds rather than minutes or days.
Yeah. I mean, so do you have a custodial wallet for the Canadian users for on the Bitcoin side?
We don't have a custodial wallet. We don't have a wallet at all. So we're just the platform that offers exchange. We are looking at some solutions for the future that would involve kind of like a collaborative custody.
Okay. I like that.
So part of the big problem, and like we've got a bunch of companies in Canada, for example, that sell Bitcoin, they use Coinbase for custody. Oof. And as we've seen, all of these companies are sort of like intermingled, right? They've got fingers in each other's pots. You've got funds moving from SBF to Almeida to FTX and whatever. And it's very unlikely that in the event of a sudden insolvency at Coinbase, that the funds of users in Coinbase custody would not get pulled into that mess.
Right.
And that's the biggest issue. And for us in Canada, like that's something happening in a different country, in a different legal jurisdiction.
Right. You're really fucked. You're actually fucked.
Yeah. It makes no sense to keep your coins in an exchange that's then going to keep them with a third party taking some unknown risks in a different country. Like that sounds completely insane. And so the way that I look at it, we're leading with the self-custody because that has to be the default, right? That's what anybody who can should do. And at the same time, like I've seen points from like Corey at Swan where he's talking about the fact that allowing users to leave their funds with Swan, with Prime Trust effectively through Swan, really opens up the market to users who don't want to go through that extra friction.
Well, I mean, The better example is I think is Strike, which is when Strike first launched, they launched as there was no custodial wallet, period. And it was just a pay button, right? It was kind of what you're describing right now in your idea for the US rollout. I don't know if your Canadian side is similar, but it was, you had a fiat balance and then you either paid a Bitcoin address or a Lightning invoice and then Bitcoin were sent there, but there was no custodial Bitcoin wallet. And what they found was through support claims, there was a ton of friction in that concept. Like as myself, I believe, you know, if you're not a Bitcoiner unless you're holding your own keys. Otherwise, you're an IOUer or something. Like you're just holding IOUs. You think you're holding Bitcoin. You have some Bitcoin price exposure, but like you don't actually hold any Bitcoin. So I'm very, you know, hardcore, I guess. I don't know if that's the right word, but I'm, you know, very strict in terms of self-custody. I tell everyone you got to self-custody, spend hours of my time, like way too much of my life. Maybe not way too much. Maybe it's a worthy mission. A lot of my life trying to educate on self-custody. But I still kind of understand the practical matters there in terms of, you know, your average person comes into Strike, well, you continue to use Strike as an example, and they just can't wrap their head around the fact that they have to go and then download a separate Bitcoin wallet to actually receive the Bitcoin. And he basically bent, he ended up having to just add the custodial Bitcoin wallet. And even still that he has a custodial Bitcoin wallet, in the fallout of FTX and when there was concerns over all these different banks and stuff with all the bank runs, he basically did they did an audit of all their user balances, and 90% of funds that go through Strike or go to self-custody, which is like, I think that's, you know, a pretty big win, all things considered, even if you still have some funds left over there.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's a really good example. So I think part of what everyone misses is like, it's very easy for us who are like up to our neck every day in the space to say, like, functionally, it's not actually more difficult to set up a Bitcoin wallet than it is to set up a bank account.
It's way easier.
Yeah, you do it one time.
If you're ever in a bear market and you're like questioning your conviction on Bitcoin, be a true masochist, walk into a bank and try and create a checking account, and you will become a massive bull on Bitcoin again. Like it's fucking pain in the ass to create a bank account. It's very easy to create a Bitcoin wallet.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that vision of like Bitcoin only, self-custody, like it's pretty simple once you understand, right? You don't really need to know that much. But when somebody gets into the space and they're new, it's a deep topic, right? And their brain power is split between like learning how all the technology works and like, who do we listen to? Are we going to listen to Breedlove or are we going to listen to Vitalik? And there's a massive amount of information coming at them, and it can take a while to sort of sort through that stuff. And so I can understand why some people want the feeling of custody, which is what everyone's used to. Like that's basically why banks exist in the first place, is it's like it's supposed to be a safer place to keep your money, not a less safe place to keep your money, right?
Right. And
people are used to that experience. And so I think when presented properly, and we haven't done this yet, so I'm still speculating. But I think when presented properly with like, you know what, you have these two options, but we want to talk to you about why you should spend the extra 6 minutes and make your own Bitcoin wallet and figure out your backups or get a hardware wallet or whatever else it may be. I think presented with education, there's an opportunity to bring more users into the space, and then also guide them down the path away from all the bullshit in the space, away from the custodial exchanges storing Bitcoin in another country, away from all the shit coins, casino coins. I'm trying to get away from the term shit coins. I want to call them casino coins. So I think
there's something there.
I think that's what we're trying to do. And we've got this idea, and it's still a little bit untested. There's some legal structures that work in both Canada and the US called bailment, which essentially allows, the theory is, the way we want to set this up is with a third party custodian that would keep one or more keys to a user's coins. But very relevantly, we would never have access to the coins, and the user would retain full legal title. So the way that it works right now is that if you're a user of a Canadian Bitcoin exchange using Coinbase custody, you have an IOU from that Bitcoin exchange, and then that Bitcoin exchange has an IOU from Coinbase custody.
Right.
And then those of Coinbase custody has IOUs from someone else. So
you're a creditor. Yeah,
exactly. And that model doesn't work. That's the part that gets everything sucked into the bankruptcy. Mt. Gox users, which is now, we're 9 years in since Mt. Gox collapse. and those users have not gotten their coins yet because they're still stuck in that bankruptcy proceeding. Right.
Or a more relevant recent example would be like a BlockFi or an FTX or something, yeah. Well, or Celsius. They're all just basic creditors.
Yeah, they're all creditors. And the reason that I point out Mt. Gox is because like those people in those companies, like the creditors of BlockFi, the creditors of Celsius, based on what we've seen before, like they might be waiting 9 more years to get those funds. And there's also a very good chance that those funds are now denominated in dollars, those debts, whether they were held in coins right. or not. So it's basically like selling your coins and not be able to get the funds for 9 years.
If you're lucky.
Yeah. If that, yeah. And then you may take a haircut at the end.
When SVB went down, I had a bunch of buddies who had were caught up in the mess or whatever. And I was like, you're never getting your money back. And then, of course, Uncle Sam bailed them out. And I was like, oh, yeah. I forgot. Like, I've just been living in Bitcoin land for so long that I just assume, like, as soon as one of these companies go down, you just might as well write it off to zero because there's no way you're going to fucking get it back.
Yeah. If the Bank of Japan could have printed more Bitcoin to bail out Mt. Gox, they probably would have.
Yeah. Yep. That is true. So I mean, let's just hone in on this point. So multi-sig, collaborative custody, I think is this what you're describing? Because this is something that I've been talking to with people, this idea of like multi-institution collaborative custody where the user doesn't actually hold a key, but like three institutions hold a key in a two of three or something. So it's like you need two of the institutions to come together to rug you instead of one or something like that.
We're looking at that. I'm leaning away from that, partly because we don't want to be holding any keys.
Okay. We don't
want to be in any position like that. And I very firmly believe that companies taking on the business of selling Bitcoins should not be the same companies taking on the business of storing Bitcoins.
Okay. And
part of the big problem with the custody model that we've seen with collapses like FTX is that it wasn't just that they were holding the coins, it's that they had all these other business activities that then exposed those coins to the risk of those other business activities. And so, like, I don't think we're doing anything risky. We're pretty conservative with our business model, but I don't want to be responsible for users' funds in that way. And I don't want to put our company out there as like a bullseye for hackers. I don't want to have to.
Right. It's a liability.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's literally a liability on your balance sheet.
Yeah, exactly. And it should be custody, if it's going to be performed at all, should be performed by a company who specializes in that. And if possible, what I'm talking about with the bailment model is that the user should maintain full legal ownership over the coins. Rather
than who holds the keys?
The custodian will hold the keys, but legally.
So a single custodian is holding just a single key, all the keys, whatever.
They do, like, depending on which kind of levels of wallets, and we're still sort of working on different models and different custodians. So there's a chance that some multi-sig may work its way in there, or multiple custodians may work its way in there. But fundamentally what it comes down to is that they are trusting a custodian, if they choose to, and the custodian just needs, in my mind, to make the security model and the business model completely clear. So this is also going to be a scenario where, like, the user will probably have to pay a small fee to hold these coins in this account.
Right.
And that, I think, is a much more direct, capitalist solution to the question of custody, because you got to think, like, if you're giving somebody your Bitcoins to hold and they're not charging you for that, why are they doing that? And where are they making the money?
Right. Yeah. I mean, this reminds me of, Caitlin Long's, Custodia Bank, right? It's like a full reserve bank. So then everyone goes, how do you make money? It was like, oh, you charge transparent fees. Because you're trusting me to secure your money for you, and I'm not going to go play games trying to, like, get yield somewhere and gamble on bonds and then get wrecked as a result.
Yeah, exactly.
But so this isn't collaborative custody at all. This reminds me of the Prime Trust model. Are we describing the Prime Trust? Like, Prime Trust, that's what Prime Trust does, right? Like, they hold it legally in your name and but have full control over it.
I'm not 100% familiar with the, like, legal structure of Prime Trust, but I think fundamentally there's a lot of similarities to that. But the big difference is that Prime Trust is also the liquidity provider in those scenarios. So they're also the company that's buying and selling the Bitcoins.
Right. They full stack.
That's where that complexity creeps in. And I really believe that like a Bitcoin custodian, in so much as they should be, I believe, a small niche of the market and not the norm of the market. But when they do exist, that's all they should do.
Yeah. I mean, so I go back and forth. So Prime Trust is a regulated trust institution.
Yeah.
They are, legally speaking, not a bank. They use 5 different banks on the back end. They do, like you said, they do order matching and processing or whatever. The custodian that Prime Trust uses is Fireblocks, which also does shitcoins. And they use, they don't use multi-sig. They use, what is it? Multi-part computation, MPC, because they need to support all the different shitcoins. But then supposedly everyone's in a segregated account that's legally in your name. But then, so I've heard this argument many times, both privately and publicly, which is the argument that's like, oh, like we should use a professional custodian that's separate from us. But I'm kind of, from my point of view, that ultimately creates a central point of failure among multiple companies. We already see multiple companies in the US that are completely dependent on Prime Trust for their MTLs, their money transfer licenses. Like MTLs in the United States is no joke. You got to get it in like almost every state. They're doing custody. They're doing order matching. It's like this one company goes down and all these different companies go with it. And then you have someone like a River that controls their whole stack in completion. And then so like at least like if their users get rugged, like they do the rugging to their users rather than like it kind of feels like trusted third party Russian dolls, you know, where it's like the user's trusting a third party and then that company's trusting a third party and that company's trusting a third party. And it's all kind of obscured.
So I definitely agree. Like the Russian dolls is a good example. And that is what's happening. Like they're all of these companies relying on one for all their order fulfillment and everything like that. And I think there's a good example in this one where the risks that are a part of a seemingly simple business like buying and selling Bitcoin can sometimes lead to unforeseen risks that could in turn affect the custody. And I think that's the worry. And right when FTX collapsed, I don't know if you were in LA for Pacific Bitcoin this year. And it was fun because it was like right when that was collapsing and we're like in the city with like FTX Arena and it's kind of crazy, but
I was not there, but go on.
So, maybe it was crypto.com arena. Yeah. It was crypto.com arena there.
Yeah. FTX Arena's in Miami.
Right. And we're at this conference and, everything's melting down and it's kind of like everybody's happy because it's like very nice. I told you so's around the board. But there was a moment where some weird stuff was going on with Prime Trust. And essentially the spread just went from like being like a 2% or 1% spread like normal to like a 6, 7, 8% spread, like just out of the blue. And nobody knew why that was. And then you started getting slow withdrawals from all the platforms on Prime Trust. And it turns out that nothing was actually wrong. It was like some kind of a bug in it, you know.
Right.
Seemingly Prime Trust was solvent and everything was fine. But as soon as that started to happen, people started to worry like, hey, my coins are in there. Like what's going on? And this is a totally different part of the business that has nothing to do with custody. Is this order fulfillment and the spread that's going on there. And people very rightly started to worry like, is this something that I need to worry about? And so I always want to be of the position that users can and should learn to use self-custody. And you're right, that's like you're not really a Bitcoin until you get there. But especially for new people coming into the space, having like a hand-holding experience and having a custodian and very similar model to what we're talking about is what we're looking at, you know, regulated trust companies that use an established legal structure to allow the Bitcoin holder to maintain ownership of the coins.
Legal ownership. Yeah.
That's the part where like hopefully in the event of a meltdown, the difference between waiting 9 years to get Mt. Gox coins out and the SBV getting a bailout and getting the funds on Monday. So it probably would be longer in the event of an insolvency event to the custodian, but the users would have a claim over their own coins. They would have ownership over their own coins in a way that no other creditors could claim any portion of.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, we went really deep on that, but your rollout, in America at first is going to be just completely self-custody only.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how does that look? Does a user like put in a Bitcoin address? Is it going to be Lightning enabled? Like, how does that look?
Out of the gate, it's on-chain only. So it's a Bitcoin address. And, you know, the workflow will be basically like you create a funding order to send us an ACH payment. Your funds land. Once your funds have landed, then you're able to make a purchase. And when you make that purchase, you are immediately sent the Bitcoins to your wallet that you provided.
So like open the app and I say, I want to buy $100 worth. And then it says, give me a Bitcoin address. And then it just debits my account and sends me Bitcoin.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have to bring up another thing that I was going to get to right at the start, but I somehow missed.
Okay. And I
saw Romel Almagro in the chat about half an hour ago saying, oh my God, is that the Dave Bradley? He's so handsome.
I saw
missed
that.
This in my bio. One thing that I am very well known for across Canada is being the strongest and best looking Bitcoin entrepreneur in Canada.
Allegedly.
Well, I mean, it's official. Yeah, but so there is a story behind that that I can tell you. I have three things to shill. I've only shilled one of them so far.
Go for it.
Right behind me here, this amazing art from my very good friend, the artist Madex.
Oh, he's amazing. We have his art at Bitcoin Park as well.
Amazing. This kind of stuff is really cool because normally when something as good as this one hits Twitter, it's gone in like an hour. But since Twitter's been fucked, I have gotten to have it in my living room for a little while. So
love it.
That one's up for sale. Everyone should go buy that art. I would say officially the strongest and best looking Bitcoin entrepreneur in Canada.
Humble too.
Very, very humble. There's more of that, more info about that on my website at bitcoinbrains.com.
So who designated you that? Let's hear this story. You can't just bring that up.
So when we had this store, 2013, we had the tagline, the fastest and safest way to buy Bitcoins in Canada. And that was like a marketing tagline, seemed fine, worked for a few years. And then when we started to form Bull Bitcoin, we were going through the process, we started looking into it and we realized there were like seven other companies in Canada now claiming to be the fastest and safest.
Right.
We were like, we got to come up with something else. And we came up with Canada's most trusted Bitcoin company. And then like a year later, we called ourselves Canada's most trusted Bitcoin company. There were like two or three companies also claiming to be Canada's most trusted Bitcoin company. And we're like, well, we got to do something about this. And I was like, fuck it. Why don't we just call ourselves something they won't copy and call ourselves the strongest and best looking? And that was kind of a joke at the time. And we didn't do it. But then a couple years later, the Canadian Securities Administrators, which is like our equivalent of the SEC, comes out. We had a big exchange in Canada called CoinSquare that got fined and the CEO was banned from ever doing anything with securities and all this stuff because they were like majorly wash trading on their exchange. And part of the reason they were wash trading was to support the claim that they were the biggest Bitcoin exchange in Canada.
Right.
And so the securities regulators come out and they say, hey, if you're an executive at a Bitcoin exchange or brokerage, like a virtual asset service provider, they call it, you are not allowed to make superlative marketing claims unless they're demonstrably true. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to pull back out this claim. And so I like, literally I've had this out there. I started claiming this about 3 years ago. I got the website up and like they haven't sued me yet. Right. So that's kind of an endorsement.
That's fucking hilarious.
Right. So that's what I mean when I say official, like according to the government, I guess, as much as you can trust that, I am
not at all
best looking Bitcoin entrepreneur in Canada, but much more importantly, according to me.
There you go. Well, thank you for giving us some insight on that. And congratulations on the title.
Thank you.
Are Americans allowed to file lawsuits in Canada? Like, can I challenge that, or is it?
So that would be like, technically anybody could sue me over that, I guess, but it's mostly, it's mostly the securities commissions that are worried about that. But, I told a little bit of this story when I was speaking in the Swan tent at Pacific Bitcoin, and somebody said, "Hey, like, why aren't you claiming to be the strongest and best looking Bitcoin entrepreneur in North America?" And I was like, "Well, like, Canada is a small place. Like, I'm pretty sure." And I can be reasonably certain that there's nobody who's both better looking and stronger than me who also counts as a Bitcoin entrepreneur.
Very pragmatic.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like, there could be some just absolutely monstrous, really good looking Bitcoin entrepreneurs that I've never heard of in the US. So I don't want to be.
You can't forget Mexico either. You have to compete with the entire Mexican population as well.
The biggest person I've ever seen in my life was in Mexico. So yeah.
There you go. That's hilarious. I had no idea. I assumed like just some random newspaper or something titled you that, but knowing it's self-titled makes it better for some reason. So, I mean, should we get to the, I mean, you have a third thing to shill. I know exactly what you need to shill. You want to shill.
Yeah.
Should we talk about this conference you're running with Sessions?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Ben Perrin and I, BTC Sessions, who I've known a really long time, from the early days of my store here, we're putting on a conference in Calgary in July called the Bitcoin Rodeo. It's going to be fairly small, probably about 400 people. It's going to be very focused on Bitcoin only content. We've had a lot of very good, well put together conferences that have way too much shitcoin stuff going on in Canada, casino coins. And the whole time I've heard people ask me about this, we put one on in 2018, which is one of the first, if not the first conference that Saifedean spoke at, on Bitcoin. And that was a big hit. We had a pony, and a really great time. And I think
I remember the pony from the
internet. Yeah, it was awesome. We rented this miniature pony, and they threw in a free miniature donkey. It was amazing.
Great deal.
Yeah. I don't know if we're going to be able to get those because the venue is not as permissive this time and not in as flexible of a spot to get a pony up there. But where we're sort of focusing, one thing that I noticed, like I go to a lot of conferences, I'm sure you do as well, and I like never watch the content.
Yep.
I watch some of it later.
Because it's recorded, so you can watch the content later, but it's all about meeting the people and having good time.
And the other thing is, like, when I go to watch that content, like, most of the people that are speaking on the main stage at BTC Miami are people that I follow pretty regularly on Twitter, and I've probably heard the same people having the same conversations already on Twitter. So for somebody who's, like, really deep in the space, it can be a little bit repetitive. And at the same time, it's like, it's not content that's accessible at all to a brand new person. So it's like really designed for the like enthusiast, but not the professional, I guess, is where you could say it lands. And so we're aiming to make the content for our conference a lot more broadly accessible and talking more about how Bitcoin affects the world and vice versa than how the technical details or the economic realities of Bitcoin will work. So we're hoping somebody who has never really learned about Bitcoin, who's seen a billboard on the side of the road, can show up and be interested and get something out of that content. We're also hoping to be able to get, like, you know, I want to see the speakers in the crowd.
Right. I dig that. No, I mean, obviously, I mean, the freaks are aware. I'm sure you're aware. I speak at a lot of events. I've had my hands in, you know, I've been consulting for Bitcoin Magazine on their conferences and their content strategy in general since it was 8 people in the depths of 2020, helped grow that company to 100 people. BitBlock Boom every year, and now Bitcoin Park, doing a lot of things at Bitcoin Park, and then obviously Citadel Dispatch, Rabbit Hole Recap. And the big priority for me has always been conversations that you won't hear anywhere else, right? Like, keep it fresh. We don't want to hear the same thing over and over again. So, knowing sessions as well, like I have no doubt that you guys will execute on that.
Yeah. We're building in a whole bunch of fun details that we're hoping will be engaging for the audience in a way that's not just Bitcoin content. So we've got little cool things like we're getting a Vuvuzela. If you remember those, like the...
Yeah, they're extremely annoying. What are you going to do with them?
Well, Ben's going to have one. He's going to be the MC for the event.
That's what they had at the South Africa World Cup. Yeah, they were everywhere. I remember them at baseball games and shit.
And if any of our panelists are so unlucky as to favorably mention a casino coin,
oh, I love that.
He's gonna blow the Vuvuzela, and we're gonna break the discussion and pivot.
Yeah, I got vetoed. I wanted to for Bitcoin 2022. I wanted to do like a slime button that I can control, just like hit them on the main stage as soon as they talked about a shit coin. But I got vetoed on that one.
Yeah.
I like that. Vuvuzela is good. It's clean too.
Yeah,
no one can ignore a Vuvuzela.
Absolutely. So, we've got that. We're planning a fashion show with all the Bitcoin merch that all the different companies bring. And one that I'm really excited for is the Bitcoin elevator pitch competition. So we'll have a bunch of speakers and some random plebs who have applied, giving their best like 45 seconds. On how to sell a stranger Bitcoin.
That's what's important. You got to perfect that one. So let's get into the brass tacks. Like how many attendees do you expect to have? Like what size event are we talking?
Yeah, it's going to be around 400. So it's going to be fairly
small. Oh, I like that size.
Yeah. There's going to be a big focus on networking. So the way we've set up the space, there's going to be a really nice area for networking and bar and an art gallery and a great place to go and meet people, as well as like some private areas that people can have meetings and whatnot. So we're hoping that it becomes an event that is useful to the people in the Bitcoin industry because of the networking and the deal making and whatnot that we all go there for and building those relationships and whatnot. And then we're also hoping that it can be at the same time useful to the people who walk in off the street. So we're one of the biggest oil cities in the world. We have 600-700 oil companies headquartered in Calgary. And this conference is right in downtown Calgary. We're in the hub of all of the oil companies.
So you're going to have a lot of mining content?
Yeah. So, content. You know, there's going to be some for sure. We're not overwhelmingly going with that, but it is a focus. I feel like every energy company in Calgary has heard extensively recently about mining. So our goal is not to like drill it into them. It's like to present a good forum for discussion. And I think we're at the point where a lot of these energy companies, they've probably all been pitched like 15 times by different Bitcoin mining companies, and they're either doing it already or they've decided not to for some reason. So I want to sell those people Bitcoin rather than like in the concept of Bitcoin. And if they're not already mining, I want to convince them that they want to be mining because Bitcoin is the future of where they need to be going.
Right. I mean, first of all, we have Rand Moore in the comments asking about the rails from Oregon to Bitcoin Park. I wonder if you mean trains. There's definitely a way to get here via trains because we have at least one freak who showed up to Bitcoin Park from that area, from the Northwest to here. Back to Dave. I really like the size of the 400 person events. You know, there's a place, first of all, I can hear your tapping because I know you don't have your headphones, so you can't hear it. There's a place as hyper Bitcoinization happens, as Bitcoin adoption happens, I really do strongly believe that it makes sense to have 20,000 person plus festivals for Bitcoin or Bitcoin culture, maybe like expand the tent, Bitcoin culture. It makes sense to me. But as someone who's been in the space as long as you, I really enjoy the smaller high signal events, and that's what we've been focused on at Bitcoin Park. Our events are 200 people or less, right?
Yeah.
It's just a high signal. You just have great conversations. It's very intimate. And to me personally, that is what I really enjoy. But to the energy side, when we first got into Bitcoin, Dave, like we couldn't really fathom where mining would go. the combination of energy and Bitcoin and what is happening in the energy world right now. We had a mining summit at Bitcoin Park in January. Is fucking amazing to to put it out there. Like it is, and to talk to someone who's on the energy side, like you talk to one of these ONG guys that got into Bitcoin as they were energy pilled first, right? Like they're like oil maximalists or gas maximalists or coal maximalists, right? And then they realize that they basically can just turn that into money. There's no such thing as stranded energy anymore, right? And you just like have a conversation with them and it just fucking clicks. They come at it from a whole different perspective. You guys seem like you would be in a particularly unique situation.
Yeah.
To focus on the energy side. So, I mean, it doesn't sound like you're dismissing it. I like talking business on air. But my advice would be lean into the energy.
Yeah.
Because it's really, really massive.
We're definitely not dismissing it. I think that you guys are actually like a year or two behind. Like the United States is a while behind on the stranded energy mining side.
Have Steve Barber, man.
Yeah, exactly. Steve Barber and I first met at the first Bitcoin rodeo, which was in 2018. Right. And at the time I was like, so back then, like I had done some consulting with a reasonably sized natural gas company, a midstream company that got a pretty good sized mining operation going in like 2017 here. And I had been a little bit involved in the process of like figuring out the containers and all the physical logistics and all this stuff that goes into, mining Bitcoin at a remote, weird site like that. And I met Steve Barber at the Bitcoin rodeo in 2018, and he was brand new into making these containers that he makes now. And they were shit. Like they were not very good. And I looked at his designs and stuff like this, and he was like, we had just bought one for like $80,000 somewhere, and he was selling this one for like $12,000, and it was not very good. And I was kind of like, well, this is not like, this is not bound for big things, but I was completely wrong. And like the detail that Steve got there that made him such a pioneer in the industry was keeping those CapEx costs down. And yep. His first design was not very good, but like he improved upon it rapidly without making a lot of extra costs added to the design. And so it became this thing where like oil companies could try it for a lot less money. And that became really meaningful, I think. And like I mentioned, I'm definitely not going to dismiss the energy side and the oil and gas for this conference. We're hoping to bring in as attendees a ton of oil and gas people.
Right.
But all of those people have already been pitched on the business model of Bitcoin mining and what it can do for energy. And, you know, we're in a position here in Alberta where like our energy is already stranded. Like we can't get pipelines built. We are very, very heavy on gas. We have tons of gas here. And, we've got like European leaders coming to Ottawa to beg our prime minister to sell them gas. And he's like, no. we're very familiar with the stranded energy, but where I think it's at is all of these people have heard the business case and the pitch for Bitcoin mining. Now they need to hear the pitch for Bitcoin. They need to hear like, not just why it makes dollars and cents in the fiat world. They need to hear why not only should they be mining Bitcoin, but they should be holding Bitcoin.
Right. So I have a question for you, and feel free to talk. I mean, you're running a publicly traded Canadian company. So, I mean, I know it's a sensitive topic. I kind of want to talk a little bit about the Canadian truckers situation. And like, did that change? I mean, obviously I'm American. I'm a Bitcoiner that's focused on the freedom oriented aspects of Bitcoin. The ability to spend or save without permission. Like Bitcoin is literally fuck you money. That's what's cool about it to me. And to me, the Canadian trucker situation was a massive wake up call. I thought it was like a massive for the Western world, for the developed world. Like this is your use case. Here you go. Like bank accounts are getting shut down. People are losing their livelihoods for protesting the government. We see it happen all the time in the developing world, but it's, this was a real world very clear-cut example in Canada, you know, which is supposed to be one of the most developed nations in the world, one of the most quote-unquote free nations in the world. Did you see like a major change there in Canada, or did most people just brush it away? Because like when I look on Twitter now, I feel like most people have just forgotten that lesson. They just don't even really remember it. It's been forgotten very quickly.
Yeah. So I think it's made a change here. It hasn't changed anything among Bitcoiners. It probably doesn't matter that much to Bitcoin Twitter because we're all in anyway, or like at least convinced of the topic. Where I've seen the change is in the sort of libertarian leaning, freedom minded people like truckers, the farmers, rural people,
right,
that aren't Bitcoiners, but have suddenly been confronted with the reality that their IOUs in the bank account, their ability to spend the funds that they have in their bank account, are contingent upon good behavior. And that good behavior is not something that's defined. It might mean you can't tweet something bad about Trudeau. It might mean that you can't go to a trucker protest. And ultimately what it comes down to is that the government can and will turn off your money if you do something they don't like.
Right.
We've all sort of seen the discussions of, you know, the move towards central bank digital currencies and all this stuff, and the desire for the globalists and the government to take the reins over your social life and be able to decide how you should spend your money based on your social life or your choices or whatever else, your political views. And we've seen that. We have offices in Calgary and Edmonton where we do in-person sales. And the majority of the people who come into our in-person offices tend to be older. They're people who can't just figure it out immediately by themselves online, and they need a bit more help. And coming from those generations, they're a little bit more emotionally attached to the idea of like going physically into a store and having a relationship with the person across the desk. And we're seeing a massive influx, both of older people, but of rural people, like very, very, way more per capita rural people than from cities. And I think those are people who already have like the seed of distrust for the government.
Right.
They're more likely to have gold or Bitcoin under their mattress, or sorry, gold or cash under their mattress. And now they're just seeing Bitcoin as like this digital alternative to cash under the mattress. And right, even before some of the times they understand anything about the monetary policy and the idea that they're being inflated away, that ability to self-custody and the ability to hold your funds and spend your funds in a way that can't be touched is definitely starting to resonate in those particular communities, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me. There's already a, they don't have to be explained the need for it, just that it exists.
Yeah.
Does that change how you look when you're like building out Bitcoin well? Does that change how you look at that? Because I mean, obviously the Bitcoin companies are probably the most vulnerable in that kind of situation.
Yeah. So there's a few ways that we look at that. One is the fact that we have those offices. So we're set up to help those people and to give them the kind of help that they want. We are a target potentially, you know, if the government decides to crack down on Bitcoin, they could shut down every business that sells Bitcoin in Canada. There have been some cases, like there was a court case with the same company CoinSquare that was wash trading, where they ended up giving something like the top 20% of their customer data to the Canada Revenue Agency.
Right.
So there's some legal battles ahead there. We're not going to give away any customer data without being forced to. And but that has to be acknowledged as a threat. Like, we exist in the physical world.
The
government has guns and they can show up. So,
yep.
We are also susceptible to a $5 wrench attack.
Yeah, I mean, with inflation, it's a little bit more expensive than $5 now, but the government has all the big wrenches.
Yeah.
I have another question for you. So I'm not I'm not like a polished Bitcoin podcaster like Stefan. So I'm just going to hit you with questions. Post shills. When you're rolling out in America, like, how do you think about America's like the one of the worst regulatory environments. I mean, besides Europe's fucking horrible. How are you going to, are you going to go state by state? Is that the play? Like you just one state at a time? Just
so slow roll out? We're going down two paths. We're exploring all the regulatory state by state stuff, but we're likely working with a payment processor that will handle our regulatory stuff.
Got it.
So that is the simple way to do it because it is a mess. Like I've stayed away from the US for years because of that mess. And like it is such a big market that it's worth tackling, but it's just like
it's a cluster.
It'd be great if everyone was on the same page.
Okay. And I have another, I mean, I know you go way back, but you've said it many times. Are you a diehard Bitcoins as a plural? Like I'm pretty sure that that doesn't make any sense to me that the plural of Bitcoin is Bitcoins. Are you willing to change your ways on that? Or are you just going to keep calling them Bitcoins? Cause that's what used to happen back in the day.
Yeah. I don't know. I fought the other battle of semantics, which is like the capital B and the small B.
Oh, what are you on this?
Well, the right answer is that the capital B refers to the network and the small one refers to the...
All lowercase. And everything should be lowercase. Is the internet... The internet's not uppercase. No one does internet uppercase.
That's true.
I mean, some do. There's like some diehards from back in the day that still refuse to lowercase internet, but most people just lowercase internet.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to the difference between like Kleenex and Kleenex. You know, you've got like the brand and then the idea of facial tissue that everyone now calls Kleenex. And there's only one internet, and that really has just become like a noun at this point, right? Whereas Bitcoin at this point is still like a proper name, the network. And from a grammatical perspective, it makes sense that it be an uppercase B, but realistically, I kind of agree. Brings to mind this interesting little detail from that first Bitcoin roadie that we put on with Saifedean. It was the first time I'd ever seen him speak, and I've seen him speak a bunch of times, and it was definitely the best one. Somebody asked something about Bitcoin culture, and you know we're all immersed in the culture and like this, like there's all these amazing pieces of the culture going on. But he said that someday Bitcoin culture is going to seem really stupid because, you know, we're all very in favor of indoor plumbing right now. And it's a virtual necessity of life.
Right. No one goes to email conferences.
Yeah, exactly.
And that sounds boring as fuck.
Eventually, that's what Bitcoin will be like, because it'll just be the only form of money. And we might even get rid of the word money. We might just call it Bitcoin.
Right.
Eventually that transition from like a proper name of the Bitcoin network, which is something that could be in most people's eyes, for example, compared to something like Ethereum, has to transition to being like just a part of society, like the internet, in which case it becomes a noun. I don't know where that distinction is.
So then lowercase.
Yeah.
You're on team lowercase now. Everything.
These are
the important issues of our time.
I was fighting the opposite fight before, trying to say that they should be two different things, the network and the asset or the unit of account. And like nobody cared and nobody was listening. So I kind of just like I've tapped out on that battle. I am not a hardcore lowercase or uppercase B proponent at this point.
This is a very sensitive topic at Bitcoin Park. There's a little bit of a civil war going on here because my co-founder Rod, when we start every meetup, he says that we're focused on the Bitcoin network with a capital B and the Bitcoin the money with a lowercase b, and it just triggers me every single time. And I think he's just wrong on this. I just think it's lowercase only. And I'm just going to do that till the day I die. And I people don't have to agree with me. They can opt into whatever they want to choose. But I'm not going to let you distract me here. Bitcoins makes no sense. Like if someone buys 0.25 Bitcoin or someone buys 1.27 Bitcoin, Like, where does Bitcoins come into play? Like, it doesn't make any sense that the plural has an S at the end.
You're right. It doesn't. I'm fully on board.
I thought you were going to fight me on it because you used it multiple times.
No, it's
I was looking for a fight, Dave. I was looking for a fight.
It's a slip. I agree with you that the S makes no sense, but I don't think you're right fully on the opposite on the other topic, because I think we're still at the point where from a logical perspective, they should be two different things. In reality, everyone's just calling them whatever they want.
Right. And
I'm like, there's a real phenomenon. There's a real phenomenon in the space of kind of like burnout, where it especially afflicts Bitcoin maximalists who, you know, just get absolutely tired of explaining what is wrong with Ethereum. And so I've taken the path for the last several years of like really, really picking my battles. And so if you're going to get a hardcore Bitcoin pitch from me, like somebody that I don't know very well, it's probably because I have a high opinion of that person and I feel like they're worth that pitch and worth my time to give that pitch. And I don't know that either the large lowercase uppercase thing or the F is worth my time at this point to die on any of those hills.
It's just, Dave, this is what gets us through all the years, you know. It's just like,
yeah,
you need to have your fun arguments because everything else is so tiresome.
Yeah. And there's an interesting point there where, you know, we've got this like community of toxic maximalists, right? And we're all like the front lines. We're like the defenders of the narrative. And I think pretty much everyone in that group are capitalists and would very much agree with the idea that like the free market should decide. And we don't want the government to protect us or anyone else from anything.
Right. But,
the market needs information. And so we need to be getting into these arguments and we need to publicly refute the bad points that are made against Bitcoin and in favor of casino coins. And these kinds of things, like it's just like sharpening the swords. You know what I mean? Like let's get together and argue amongst ourselves about the S so that we can be, so that we can be ready when we got to refute some actual bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know if I believe in that anymore. Like, I mean, for something like the block size war, it was absolutely imperative, right? You know, it really came down to users, you know, running their own nodes and using their own nodes. It required individual action. And there was a little bit of, I fucking hate politics. There was a little bit of politicking about it, right? It was gathering user support. But with shit coins or casino coins, there's something there with casino coins, by the way, because I always say gambling. I like using gambling as a word because I also believe a big free market guy. If you want to gamble, everyone has the right to get wrecked. Go gamble. You know, you'll come find your way. But with Bitcoin versus shit coins, I strongly believe that the shit coins are trending to zero in terms of Bitcoin. Like, it really does not matter how many podcasts, how many books, how many YouTube videos come out on it. Like, it's just less hard money. They're all competing monies. All the promoters of shitcoins will pretend it's not a competing money unless it's prudent for them to do it, expedient for them to do it at some given time. But they're all competing monies and they're less hard money. So as a result, they should trend to zero long term against Bitcoin. We've seen that throughout history, throughout the short history of Bitcoin and shitcoins. I think there'll always be shitcoins, but there's always different shitcoins. It's like you see them, they like come and go. Like no one remembers like the first generation of shitcoins or the second generation. And then like Solana came out and then like they went through their pump cycle. Like Tron comes out, it goes through its pump cycle. Right. And like in 4 years, there's going to be like a whole different set that we just don't even know. And like they're gonna go through their pump cycle. It's gonna be infuriating. Like the X shit coin or whatever they name it, is like the trolls on Twitter are gonna be annoying. But like none of that fucking matters because it'll just trend to fucking zero. But when I look at the education side, it's not to like protect Bitcoin the network. It's users are gonna lose money. Like individuals will lose money. And like if you can, you know, help a few people avoid that fate. And we see that a lot. Like, I've talked to freaks who are like, I just never went through that phase because I just came straight in through rabbit hole recap. And I just knew. So I never had to touch the stove, because you just explained stories of people getting there, touching the stove for me ahead of time. But I don't think it's necessary.
Yeah, that's 100% the way I look at it. Like, Bitcoin is inevitable, as is the eventual collapse of all these casino coins. And when I'm giving someone my Bitcoin pitch, I'm not doing that to help Bitcoin. I'm not doing that to help adoption. I'm doing that to help them.
The individual.
Yeah.
Because you respect the person and you just want to help them.
Yeah, exactly. Because the saying of like, everyone gets into Bitcoin as early as they deserve, or everyone...
The price they deserve, I think, is the
core. Yeah, exactly. I guess if I meet someone and I find that they're like ideologically aligned, like a rational person, especially people that are business owners, capitalists, the builders of the world, those are the people that I want to convince that Bitcoin is in their best interest, because the best thing for Bitcoin is a whole bunch of Bitcoiners operating in their own rational best interests,
right?
Building towards whatever they want to build.
That's the cool part about Bitcoin, is you don't have to be like a benevolent priest-like character. You just have to be greedy, and the system gets more robust as more people are greedy. That's what makes it work, because all the other fucking incentives in our societies are based around this idea that like people are just going to be these magical benevolent people, and they just never are. They're always corrupt assholes, and those are the guys who lead up to power, and then they ruin everything. So like, you need systems that are designed in the opposite way. They're designed under the assumption of greed. Those systems are robust. That's why Bitcoin's robust.
And you can speak to it probably more than anyone else, that like, people, when given the freedom to be, are naturally good, and they are naturally benevolent. You know, you've got a stream of donations coming in, and it's the people that want to force others to benevolence that are the ones that are always the opposite of that. They're the ones that are looking to get by without creating value. They're the moochers and the leechers that want to siphon away all the value from all the people who actually build things for the world.
Well, it's like the Stanford prisoner experiment or whatever. It's like, if you give people a path where they can be more powerful than other individuals, it's the worst people that are the ones that climb those rungs to become more powerful, right? Like, it's just natural human tendency.
I can't imagine wanting to be like in charge of an entire country or something like that. Like, it seems like just a terrible idea. Like, why would a person, like a rational, sane person, want for other people?
Yeah, exactly. So it's self-selection, right? In that way. Dave, I mean, this has been great. I look forward to seeing what y'all build with Bitcoin. Well, I look forward to, I mean, I already told you I'm not giving you a definitive yes on the conference.
Yeah.
But I will let you know, but I look forward to seeing the results regardless, whether or not
I make it.
What
if you get a pony?
If you get a pony, I'm more likely. If you get a unicorn, definitely, I'm definitely in. If you can somehow figure out a unicorn.
I don't think unicorns are really on brand though.
Yeah, well, that's true. They're more Ethereum, but I also know they don't exist. So I'm able to definitively say that to you. Well, you have to get a, have you, are you not trying to line up a bull?
You know what? If we were going to get a bull, it would probably be a bison.
Oh, that'd be pretty awesome. I like the idea of a real, like a bison bull there. Do bison have horns, right?
They do. Yeah, they have huge horns. The problem with bison is you can't really control what they do. They just do whatever they want.
They just let it loose in the crowd and just see what happens. Personal responsibility. Have everyone sign a waiver. but yeah, I look forward to the event. I look forward to Bitcoin Well. I appreciate you coming on. You don't do many podcasts, so it's great to have you on Dispatch.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great discussion.
I mean, actually, I was about to wrap it up, but I have one more question for you while I have you.
Okay.
Once again, not Stefan, so it just whatever comes to mind. So this podcast is called Scylla Dispatch. why did I call it Scylla Dispatch? I called it Scylla Dispatch because of that Reddit post back in the day. Do you remember the Reddit post where it was actually anti-Bitcoin Reddit post, but it was about Bitcoiners living in citadels. And it hit me as a young person. And I treat it like hyperlocalism, this idea that these large centralized systems that have never been larger than they are today are corrupted. They will crumble and we will have a reversion to the mean. We'll have a bring back of these like hyper local societies, which is what has always been the case up until, you know, relatively recently in human history, with a mix of technology coming into it play. So like, because we have Bitcoin, and because we potentially have drones and drones, autonomous drone swarms and all this other shit and mesh networking, like that you could have global trade in a situation where you have hyper-localism. What are your thoughts on that? Is that like batshit crazy or does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it for sure does. So I read Atlas Shrugged.
Yes.
When I was like 18 and I kind of got it. And then I read it again at the start of 2020 and it was super depressing to me. It was like, this is what's happening in the world, is the State Science Institute and the Anti-Dog Eat Dog League and all these bizarre, like supposedly like benevolent government organizations stealing all the money from the world. And very shortly after that, I read The Sovereign Individual. I heard you talking about that with CK last week.
Yep.
And one of the things that gave me the most hope for the world from The Sovereign Individual is this idea that the time of the large scale nation state is done. And this concentration of violence that was necessary to defend capital for the last 2000 years is now shifting. And we've seen pretty much since the Vietnam War that it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to win a war if you have the largest army, the most tanks, the biggest guns, etc. Right. We've just been moving in that direction where it is feasible for small scale nation states. And I think what will eventually move towards like city states to exist in the world because the efficiency of violence has increased significantly. And so I think that's where we're going to go. We don't need to live in a world where there is sort of like a hall monitor of the world underpinning all global trade with the threat of violence. And that's kind of the situation that we live in right now where, you know, we saw things like the revolution in Libya with Muammar Gaddafi, who was trying to go against that global financial system.
Right. And
they took him out, basically.
Right. He had a gold-backed shitcoin that he wanted to launch.
Exactly. And so I do think that we're moving towards, with all of those technologies that you're talking about, I think the three pillars that we really, really need to be able to create self-sustainable sort of extreme localized micro communities like that, that may result in like city states or regional
citadels
or whatever it is. Yeah. That like hyper-localism is, we need, of course, money, and we've got that solved now. We have money that does not rely on the state, which is another one of the predictions from The Sovereign Individual.
Doesn't require trust.
Yeah. We need the ability to communicate in a way that cannot be censored through those same sort of government crackdowns. And that's starting to get there. There's still a lot of central points of failure. You know, like
I think that might be Nostr.
Yeah, absolutely. So Nostr is the most promising one of those solutions right now, I think. There's some really cool stuff that Start9 Labs is doing, for example. We do need a decentralized communication layer.
Right.
And there are a bunch of pieces that live on top of that.
And we need like the physical mesh networking component still. Like,
yeah.
It's not really fleshed out yet.
Yeah, exactly. So like there's actually weaknesses on the communication in both directions, in the sense that our internet service providers downstream are kind of like one potential bottleneck. And then on the other direction, we've got like things like all the websites, all the domain providers, all the ways that we find and
right,
figure out how to communicate with each other. So both of those things need to get more decentralized. And then the last pillar, I think, of a free society is the ability to arm ourselves, and the ability to protect yourself from small scale violence without relying on someone else having a monopoly on violence.
Yep.
And the 3D printing
game changer.
So I think
that's out of the bag on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. You cannot put that one back in the box. And I think we're well on the way to all of those things. And I think, like, if the governments of the world went fully hostile against the citizens, and in like a V for Vendetta type scenario, we would be in a pretty good spot right now, but not as good as we need to be, and not as good as we will be a few years from now.
Yeah. No, I agree. But I almost think, like, part of it is, like, iron sharpens iron. Like, it doesn't really happen without the pressure, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So. It's very unlikely, I think, given how far those systems have come, that we actually even ever get to a V for Vendetta type totalitarian situation, because I think we're ahead. Those of us who want freedom from a technological perspective are ahead. And it does not seem at all like the people that are trying to subjugate us really know what's going on. And that's kind of our fundamental advantage, I think, is that these people are either evil or incompetent.
Right. A mix of both, probably.
Yeah, probably in most cases.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, well, I think we're very aligned on that. I would say one thing, though, is V for Vendetta is based in the UK, and there's no right to bear arms over in the UK. Maybe the 3D printing changes that, but probably a little, it's a lot more likely over there than over here.
It is. And that the protests that we saw in Hong Kong were a prime example of how bad shit gets when there is
that
no
right so bad.
And I think some of that stuff, even the fact that we had our trucker protests like violently shut down by the police is a symptom of the fact that we don't we have a lot of guns in Canada, but nothing like the United States. We don't have an enshrined right to bear arms. And so, the police that were trampling an old woman with a horse in downtown Ottawa, were not worried about the possibility of this crowd pulling out guns, partly a cultural thing, but also there's just not as many guns here. Whereas you look at some of the protests, like what happened in Hong Kong, there was people making bow and arrows.
They had nothing.
Police. And then even some of the COVID protests in Australia, where they have basically no guns, they've taken away the guns a long time ago, they're getting really extreme. And you're seeing people getting their face slammed into the pavement for not wearing a mask on a public street. And that's something that I don't think would happen in most of the United States, because there is a natural need to respect the population because everyone has guns.
Yeah, I mean, this is the viewpoint that I come out with Bitcoin in a different way than our most famous spook does, is that it comes down to defensive tools that empower individuals. Like, if you have defensive tools that empower individuals, you will live in a more free world. And Bitcoin is one of those defensive tools, because it makes it much more difficult to seize people's wealth and to block them from making any kind of payments or purchases. And as we have more of those tools, and I would, I'd put 3D gun printing in there. I'd put guns in general in there, firearms in general in there. We will live in a more free world that will be a more localized world, that will be more of a individual, like hyper-localized kind of centralized, not decentralized world. And as a result, we'll be more free. And that's kind of the trend I've been watching. And that's what attracted me to Bitcoin. That's attracts me to encryption on messaging side, right? That's what attracts me to Nostr in terms of just robust communication protocol. It's interoperable and mesh networking, all this stuff. Like, it all feels like it's coming together. That's what gives me hope. I call myself a doomer optimist. I think I think it's impossible for this house of cards to kind of transition without some kind of chaos. But I think if we have the right freedom tech, like, we can reduce the darkness before we get to the light on the other side, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I like that that way of putting it, as defensive tools. That's kind of a good short way to describe all the things that I was just talking about there.
Yep.
And I think the way the world is right now, I would be very, very worried for the world if we didn't have Bitcoin. I'd be very worried for myself and my family if I didn't have Bitcoin. And I can extend a lesser version of that sentiment to those other things like the 3D printing and the communication. I think Bitcoin is the base layer for all of those things. You know, we need money that doesn't work in favor of the people trying to subjugate us. And as long as we keep paying their salaries, they're going to keep doing that. And Bitcoin is the opt-out.
Really well said, Dave. Dave, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us on Dispatch. I look forward to seeing you again soon in person. You have any final thoughts for the audience before we wrap?
Yeah, I mean, you can find me on Twitter as Bitcoin Brains. I feel like Twitter is maybe on its last legs. Kind of terrible these days, but I'm still there. And I'm also on Nostr. I don't know what the best way to share a Nostr thing.
That's right. Nostr is very early. You're going to read your pub key?
Yeah. But
do you have it listed on Twitter? Is it in your bio on Twitter?
I've posted it on Twitter. So I'll post it again right now on Twitter as well. And you can probably search me as well on there. And then, yeah, you can check out Bitcoin Well at bitcoinwell.com. Bitcoinwell.com USA has the info about our upcoming US expansion, which hopefully some of your listeners will be interested in. And check out my website at bitcoinbrains.com. It's got info about me being the strongest and best looking Bitcoin entrepreneur and a very important section highlighting some of the stakes that I've had. So check it out.
And what about if people want to go to the event?
Oh, yeah. The event, bitcoinrodeo.com. You can also message the Bitcoin Rodeo on Twitter. Or message me on any of those platforms if you have any interest in coming or participating. Tickets are available on the website for fiat, and message me if you want to buy them in Bitcoin.
Awesome. Do you have a NIP5 on Nostr? Do you know what a NIP5 is?
Yeah,
like, so, it looks like an email address. Like I'm Odell at werunbtc.com.
Yeah, let me look here. It's
that's Bitcoin what you should Brains. Share.
Yeah, Bitcoin Brains at BTCW. Dot app.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah.
Bitcoin Brains at btcw.app.
Yep.
There you go. That's his Nostr. And I'm Odell at werunbtc.com.
Perfect.
If for some reason you're not hitting me up on Nostr. Nostr's a future freaks. Anyway, Dave, thanks for joining. This was a great conversation. I look forward to our next one. Huge shout out to the freaks who joined us in the live chat. I appreciate you. And once again, I truly appreciate all the donations you guys send, support the show. It means a lot. It keeps me going day in and day out, even though it gets so tiresome sometimes. All those links are at SyllaDispatch.com. You know, SyllaDispatch.com/donate to go straight to the donation page. SyllaDispatch.com/chat will bring you to our Matrix chat, which is always a fun time, 24/7, 365. I love you all. Thank you, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
Stay humble, Stack Sats. Peace.